This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann. Mawira is back from the States, but not quite ready for recording shows yet. So I am back with Tim Lynch.
Hello, Sam.
Who has been roving around the Baltic.
I have been roving around the Baltic. So this week we're going to listen to a chat that I had with Hemlick. He is a rapeseed, mustard and oil producer who goes under the Lemsgard. I think I said that completely wrong. That's his trade name. And the reason is I had a chat to him about being a carbon neutral producer.
Yeah, my name is Henrik Hansen. I'm the owner of Lemsgard on Bornholm. We are producing cold-pressed rapeseed oil, or canola. I don't know which name you're using. And on top of that, we are producing mustard as well. Yeah, we actually started back in 2003 when the company was started, and that owner was called Hans. He was a local farmer, and he actually from the beginning had the idea of doing something more sustainable. So I've been part of the company now for 6 years, been owning it for 5 years, and I've just continued that process. So he started slowly with getting solar panels on the roof. I think it's 60 kilowatt we have today, and that is covering around 70% of what we are using. But the rest is now bought in, like kind of green certified. So it's actually from local windmills on the island. So I'm one of the few companies that actually got that part of the electricity. So it's 100% locally electricity.
So we're going to come back to talking more about food, because that's your interest. But first you're asking him questions about the energy. I think that's because when he talked about being sustainable, his go-to on that was about the electricity they're using.
Yeah, so that's the first part of his go-to, is about the energy that is using. But if we go back to the idea of sort of scope 1 and 2 emissions, scope 1 being those direct emissions that he can control, and the 2 and 3 are the ones that are kind of a little bit out of his control, 3 is completely out of control. Where the issues for, say, a restaurant, which is the area that I'm looking into, has problems, is in order for a restaurant to be carbon neutral, all the ingredients and the materials that are coming into the restaurant need to be carbon neutral. So restaurants are in this really sort of difficult position in that they're obliged to start changing and evolving the way that they operate to come in line with Paris agreements, etc., etc. But in order for that to happen, they have to start looking at upstreams. So the reason for having a chat for Hemlock was he is in that process. So he is providing restaurants, he's providing consumers with a raw-based product, which is carbon neutral.
We talked last week to Klaus from Energy Bornholm and how the island is not quite independent in terms of energy, but is moving in that way. Does that factor into the decisions that individual producers are making?
I think it's definitely part of it. Energy security is something that they are acutely aware of, particularly primary producers such as Hemlock, who we're talking to here. But the way they're approaching that notion of resilience is quite different. And I think that the reason it's being pushed is because it is being viewed as a role of sustainability, as coming in part of the Paris agreements. The bit where it becomes interesting, I guess, when you're listening to people like him, is the way they use these things to enhance or strengthen their business model. So I just blatantly asked them, is it cost effective to use energy which is just produced on the island of Bornholm?
No, actually not. It would be cheaper just to have or buying a normal electricity, because of course it costs something to have it 100% local. Yeah. It also costs something to maintain a little bit of the solar panels. And we have like a tax system in Denmark that is not 100% following the route of making sustainable electricity, yeah. At least not for a small business as we are. Yeah. But for us, it's a very good story, and that is the strategy we have, is to become 100% self-sufficient.
And so that story, you're...
Yeah, I'm doing that every time I'm having a discussion with retail stores. Their main focus is still price, but of course it always helps to have the whole sustainable story in place.
So the next question really is, generating your own power a model for all businesses?
I think every business should have a focus on it. If you have a roof, there's plenty of room for solar panels, and just put solar panels on it. Instead of taking farmland out and putting solar panels as we're doing today, I think that's pretty ridiculous. We have plenty of roofs that could do that job. I think that is a very nice way of doing things. My heating in this factory is also 100% sustainable.
So how does the heating...
Yeah, so in the past we had an oil burner just heating up the factory. Now we got installed kind of a wood stove, but for pellets. And in the past, so I get the rapeseed from the farmer directly into our factory. I have big silos. I store the seeds for a full year production. And we clean them before we're putting them into the silos. And there you have leaves and other plant-based stuff, weed, which you don't want that into your silo because it has a lot of moisture into it. So we separate that in the first cleaning process. And from that, we are pressing pellets. And with that, we are heating the whole factory. So we don't have any oil burner left. We had a chimney standing outside, and we took that one down this summer. So we are 100% pellet-based on residues from the cleaning process. And that is actually stuff that would have gone back to the fields or somewhere.
Using residues from the process to power the plant, they're starting to think in systems here.
Yeah, absolutely, completely systems. And there's a lot of cogs that need to mesh together to get that system to work in a symbiotic fashion. And I guess it's the scalability of that model where it gets kind of fascinating. If we think back to what Klaus was saying last week, he was talking about, it's large enough to have significance, but small enough to be agile, or something to that effect. I can't quite remember what it was. But this is another example of where that's happening, where what he is doing is reliant on a whole lot of other cogs meshing together. And there's a lot of goodwill within that. And I suppose when we look at these smaller islands, it's very easy to say, well, they all know each other. So I asked them, have you had to ask your suppliers to start operating in a different way so that your business can start functioning?
Yeah, we have a discussion with our farmers. We are using mainly the same farmers every year. We know they have a very good quality. We also ask them to how they put the seeds in the ground. You can actually put them actually either in rows, or you can put them in a diagonal from each other. If you do that, you actually get more plants per area, but we would like to have them on a row, because then you can mechanically clean the rows easier. And by that, you don't need to use pesticides. They only use pesticides if you really have a big attack from fungus. And also if we have some very small type of flies that are actually attacking the plant. And if they attack that, the whole, it's gone. So that is actually the only pesticides they're using. For the rest, they doing a very fantastic job. And actually, they don't need to do it, but they also find it a good story to deliver to us. They can, when they go to the shop, they know that I actually made some very good seeds for Lensgard, and now I see them in the store. You have the normal farmers that are normally just working bulk, and they are shipping it to the local harbor, and that is then going by boat away. That's fine. We are working with farmers that are close by the factory. They don't need to drive all the way to the harbor to and maybe queuing for a couple of hours, they can come here directly, empty the wagon, and then drive back immediately. So they also see some type of benefit. And then they just like the whole story of that they are producing something for a local company that are then kind of exporting that to the rest of it.
We heard about this over the last couple of weeks on Bornholm, that a part of that is the community pride, community ownership, not necessarily the individual parts of the system, but the fact that they're doing a thing together.
Yeah, I definitely. And when I was there, I did feel that someone did some of that spillover because they were traditionally a fishing community, and that's where they stem from. And fishing communities are traditionally, you know, very tightly knit. So I sort of asked them, you know, is this business part of the community?
Yeah, we are 100% part of our local community. We are like sponsoring the. We have a cycle team that is part of the whole big. Yeah, kind of first division. We are part of that. We are sponsoring all football, handball teams and what have you. We have all the school kids from sixth grade when they start to learn to cook in school. They're all coming here. Get a tour in the factory. They see how we are producing stuff. We are talking about how to produce local food. And so they also get an idea of it is actually coming from somewhere. You know, the food is something you just take from the shelf. There's a story behind it.
It still remains that interesting interplay of doing the right thing because it's the right thing to do with the compliance underneath that, but also that connection to buying something off the shelf. There's a story behind that and the importance of that story.
Yeah, and that story, the development or the building of that story, I mean, you could call it branding if you like, but it's actually more of a community-based story, was core to a lot of those businesses. And it was the communication of that story, the communication of that identity, the communication of those values, which came across really strongly with the businesses.
No, we, I think it was like in 2005 or 2008, we had this small association called Gourmet Bornholm, where we had like all the small producers went together. They hired a guy trying to do some marketing and getting a kind of a story about branding Bornholm. And that has helped actually getting much more local companies, small startups, people coming back from Copenhagen after studying, building up a small type business. And we are meeting, I think, every 3 months. Everybody knows each other. We can help each other. If I have an issue with a machine and I know that the guy 15 kilometers from me who is making snaps or gin, he has the same type of bottling machine. He come and help me, I come and help him. That is extremely valuable. And when you have that small community, it's also easier to invent new kind of products which are produced locally or can be produced locally. So we have, I know we have now 10 farmers that are making a small company called Foods Bornholm. So they're looking into kind of green proteins. And from that, they are then trying to build that up. You have in Aakirkeby, we have the local guy making flour. He has export to the most of Denmark. We have a guy making pate, a small butcher, but he's not making. He's making now, I think, close to 15 million pates for retail. I'm having a market share of, I think, between 70 and 80%, both in my own label and in private label. And we have a guy making small biscuits also here, who's also very famous. So locally, in this small town with, I don't know how many are living here, 1,500, we have at least four companies that are really known. And 15 years ago, we were not existing. It's because we started branding our regional business kind of from Bornholm. And we got, people got to know us, that products from Bornholm is maybe not the cheapest, but it has a very high quality. I think the quality is the main key selling point. That is really quality and integrity. Yeah.
In every
exactly. Quality. Exactly. Sustainability, local resources. So my rapeseed, for instance, it's just a good story. It's difficult to, I would never get stuff from Romania or Germany or whatever. Why should I? Yeah. It might be cheaper, but I'm also playing football with a local farmer who is delivering rapeseed to me, right? So it's one big family.
He's playing football with his suppliers. is that the hidden message, that it's about the strength of the community?
I think so. I think possibly it is. Maybe it is. Maybe, like, I mean, if you think of a business as really just a series of like-minded people trying to do something to move forward because it's generally what you're interested in, maybe that is. Maybe that's it. The notion of sustainability is actually just rooted in the fact that we need to do something for the betterment of everybody else. And that was the feeling that I got from a lot of these conversations. Is like, yeah, we do this, we run business, we have to make a profit, we should do, but there's all this other stuff that we need to try and do. And they don't view those other bits as being something which impedes their businesses. They see it as something that enhances their business.
Talk about enhancing. You got a song for us?
Yeah, so a couple of pretty significant things happened to the music world, Sam. We're in New Zealand Music Month, and last week Steve Albini died, which was very sad. So I thought for this one we'd try and combine two of those two things. Steve Albini, of course, very famous for recording Joanna Newsom, Nirvana's In Utero, which is an astonishing album. And it's easy to overlook the effect that he had even in little old Dunedin. He was actually booked in to produce Dido Die's album. Unfortunately, this wee thing called the global pandemic got in the way of that happening. But another Dunedin band called High Dependency Unit, or HDU, actually toured with him as part of Shellac. And they recorded this album in Steve Albini's recording studio. So this is HDU with Concentricity. Thank you.
Bubble sprite of the forest of Orokonui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mihi aranu kia koutou, ko tāho hau. I hope you're all having the best day, beautiful superstars, in your beloved universes, and I really hope, wherever you are, and whatever's happening around you, this journey that we're all on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining, and illuminating for you more and more each day, who you are. A triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique, and here, making things better. Thank you. And now I know for us all, the last several years have been very tough, and it's so important that we give ourselves and each other the care, the compassion, the time, the space, the love, to recover, to recalibrate, to reimagine, to reinvent, to re-embody and to reconnect with who we all are now, having experienced this global leveler, this global unimaginable change, which it was for us all. And I know for myself, of course, that I'm so grateful that Orokonui Eco Sanctuary, my heart's home workplace, survived. I know many didn't, which is so sad. And many people have had to move on and find new ways of doing, being, seeing, feeling, new pathways, new work opportunities, all of these things. I've been very fortunate to be able to stay at Orokonui. And I've had a wonderful time there recently. We've, of course, now been able to welcome back our international friends from around the world, and connecting with them and speaking with them is always a great pleasure and privilege, as it is with all of the people that I encounter in my life in every moment, and hearing their experiences. And again, of course, it comes back to the healing power of the living world, the real world, the natural world, of which we are a part. And I've been so grateful to be in the forest listening to the birds. We now have a kaka cam, so anytime we feel like it, we can see what the kaka are up to and the other manu are up to via this amazing webcam. And we haven't had the technology in the time that I've been at Orokonui over the last 15 years. It hasn't been up to it, but now we're very lucky with Port Otago and Uniphone that we can see this particular vignette in the forest, what's happening, and hear all the bird song. And we had some wonderful comments for the video, for the live cam, saying, you know, I have it on and I just listen to the bird song. And how beautiful that we can do that, how wonderful that we can do that. And of course, as a species, we are so creative. We're constantly reinventing and inventing and creating new ways of experiencing the world and making things better for ourselves and other species that are with us. And this is something I really love about us. I love our creativity. And of course, recently here in Aotearoa Stunedin, we've been so lucky that the Aurora Australis has been with us. So there's been this massive solar flare, which is really exciting. And Te Ra, the sun, has been sending out huge amounts of energy to the wider solar system, and our planet has benefited from this. And so very lucky, I'm staying with my whānau on the peninsula at the moment, and we went out and we witnessed this most beautiful aurora. And we took with us, of course, my godmother, who's like my other mum, her giant family heirloom doll, Marguerite, who of course is a force unto herself. And she's more than 100 years old, and she definitely has a way of summoning and celebrating the world around us. So we had a wonderful time with her. And I just hope for you that wherever you are and whatever's happening around you, this joy that we can find in the creative realm is really with you throughout your day, throughout your night, consciously, subconsciously, unconsciously. This creative force is always working within us all to help us to express those unique gifts that we've come into the world with. And I'll look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. I'm talking with Tim Lynch, who has been talking with Hemlik Hansen.
So the question I sort of started posing Hemlik at this stage, it was, has he seen a change in the way people's views on buying local? They put a lot of effort into the rebranding, the narrative, the telling of their stories. Those, but as is the way with food, you know, people have their phone on contract, they're locked into mortgages with high interest rates. The one variable and that we can change the amount we spend on is food. So I asked him that, you know, have you seen a change on people's views on buying local food?
But it's also changing back again very fast, right? Because then you have inflation, prices go up, and then and people are then trying to save whatever they can. And there are some prices that just went up like crazy, so that's heating for your houses and petrol and electricity and stuff like that. And so they have to save money somewhere because they still want to go on their holiday. So it is actually very often food where they then buy a kind of a cheaper product.
It's an interesting connection between local and sustainability. A few years ago, I was on the City Council's sustainability advisory group or something, and we tried to set up a buy local, buy sustainable brand, local branding, and it fell apart over the fact that those two things are not the same.
Yeah, there's a tension there. There's absolutely that. I think a lot of that, to be fair, because I also am on this kind of loosely affiliated with the council group, and I think that's been replaced by resilience, this notion of food resilience. And I think that really got hammer time when the sort of the findings of what would happen in New Zealand in the case of a rather large earthquake and how long we'll be able to sustain ourselves for would go. So, yeah, I like to hope that we're sort of moving past a lot of those things.
But this seems to be a thing which is not unusual for them now. No, we're not playing Tom Jones. This seems to be part of their core now.
Yeah, I think so. It's part of who they are. It's part of the DNA of their business. It's the way they operate. It's woven through everything from food to tourism to the way businesses operate. And it's at the municipal level. And I think, and I'm not throwing stones at the DCC here, or maybe I am, I'm not sure, but if you looked at the cooperation between the municipality that was occurring in Bornholm and the collaboration that would occur with, say, the Dunedin City Council and our businesses, their approach is wildly apart. And I don't think it's got anything to do with sort of political polarity and where they sit. I think it's actually got to do with a Scandinavian sense of pragmatism. And so I had to ask him, could you imagine doing business any other way?
No, I couldn't. The stuff we are working with at the moment is all based on how can we then increase our solar panels, or everything is thought through at the moment. Or we actually just finalized a project now where we actually have moved away from one type of glass bottle to another one. So there's less glass in the bottle, therefore less energy used by making the bottle. We have been looking into our cardboard, the boxes. There we have also moved in a different direction. Our labels, there's glue on the label, so the back paper for that, we have now bought it from somewhere else. So we actually ship it back to Germany to that factory. They can separate the silicone from the paper. So now we are getting more and more into the nitty-gritty stuff, right? To kind of finalize the whole circle.
How much of that?
We absorb most of it, actually. But I also think it's important that we are the best in that field to be sustainable. We started before it became popular. So now we just need to focus on always doing the right thing. And the cost, yeah, it's a little bit more. But we are actually looking into now more and more export. Difficult for us to grow much more in Denmark. Our main competitor is actually not rapeseed oil, it is actually olive oil. Olive oil is still like 8 times bigger consumption-wise compared to a cold-pressed rapeseed oil. And to be honest, I don't really understand that. It's just because it's a habit. People are using olive oil. I actually have a product that are more healthy, that can take a higher degree when you're frying, 100% locally produced. Not the flavor is not as strong as an olive oil. So there's a lot of good benefits. Mm. But that is the main story that needs to be told, actually. Buy something local. Why are we actually importing stuff from South Europe when we have local fields all around Denmark?
Have we got the equivalent? Are the things that we should be buying local that we're not?
Oh, absolutely. We 100% do. I mean, we have a local farmers market, which is fabulous. If you look at the supermarkets, the New Zealand-owned supermarkets, I should probably be more specific about that, they tend to have a minimum of about 15% of their products, which they choose, which is locally done. I think that could be extended upon. One of the big issues which is threatening us is the likes of Hemlock, and what he's doing around Dunedin. We are getting less and less producers, and that's just the reality of the value of the farm is shifting. The dirt is worth more as a subdivision than it is as a farm which is producing food for people. The children that would normally inherit it and the succession that would occur there, the interest often now lies elsewhere. And so, as we do, we look for efficiencies in production, which usually lies offshore. And that's sort of the threat to localised food resilience is in that space there.
What do we need to do to change that? Is it a buy this, it's better for the community, for the environment? Maybe the answer is going to be and here. Sneak preview, there's going to be an and. Or buy this, it's tastier.
And? Yeah, there's both of those. And it's lower in carbon, and it's tastier, and it's supporting people, and there's a whole lot of positive downstream effects and all of these things. I think what we have to be careful of is when we start putting a premium on locally produced food, it can have the effect of being punitive. And what we don't want to do is have punitive measures occurring. What we want to have is like reinforcing positive things which are good for the wider community, food producers and consumers both. The narrowing of the gap between those two things is where I think resilience lies, and food resilience, and how we start going about it. I think, you know, sort of the stuff that Hemlock talks to here is actually food resilience and narrowing that gap between the consumer and the producer, and also the sharing of that knowledge and information.
So there's a story to be told.
There's a story to be told, and I sort of wondered, do the restaurants help in the telling of their story?
And restaurants are telling a great story most of the time. I just have a product which is really niche. I'm just the oil, right? They have more focus on its local vegetables. That potato is coming from there, and the local meat is from that guy, and stuff like that. So that isn't the normal story on a restaurant if they want to focus on anything, yeah. And maybe not the oil they're frying with.
You go to restaurants and it does say that usually on the expensive stuff, locally caught fish or something.
Yeah, 100%. And often, in a lot of restaurants, the menu itself is used as a form of advertising. We are using blah, 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 this. We're using XYZ that. So I was somewhat surprised to hear that. And one thing I think in New Zealand we're good at doing is we are good at reinforcing a lot of those producers. However, and here's another but, a lot of that has been driven by the producers, and the producers that have got the clout to do that are generally the larger producers. So, for instance, the smaller regenerative farmers in central Otago that don't have the clout to approach a larger organisation has multiple restaurants, whereas, say, a Silverfern Farms is able to do that.
We've skipped over what Lensgaard and its company, what they actually do.
Yeah, this is true. Well, maybe we should recap. We'll let Hemlock explain that.
We harvest is around 1st of August, 20th of July until mid-August, normally 1st of August. And then we are getting seeds in for full year production. And that just takes between 10 and 14 days, I would say. Because it's all about moisture content in the seeds, stuff like that. So farmers are funny people. They are looking at the same field for a full year, And when the neighbor starts harvesting, they all start harvesting instead of just waiting another 2 or 3 or 4 days until it's actually the moisture contents come down and stuff like that. So it happens very often that I actually get the first load in, and then I tell him, hey, wait another 3 days, right? Yeah, just take it easy. But that's when you have a good relationship with the farmers, you can do that.
So that relationship with the farm.
Absolutely, yeah. They can deliver to Rønne Harbour with a moisture content easily up to 13-14%. I don't want anything higher than 9%, and I'm then drying it down to 7%. And they are very good, the farmers I have. Yeah, if it's below 9%, it's actually stable. Then they can be in my silos for several years without nothing happen. But I'm also dehulling the seeds. So I'm only pressing dehulled rape seeds, and all the bitterness and the color is sitting in the shell. So I don't want the shell in my production, and I'm the only one in North Europe having that process. So you get a very high quality oil out of that, and for that I need a water moisture content below 7%.
So
the more dry it is, the less energy I also need to spend on drying it.
Of course.
So it's again the whole circle of getting a good product, dry product in, let the farmer wait another 3 days if the sun is shining.
So the takeaway message is farmers are funny people, is that?
It was pretty controversial stuff. I'd like to see the translation of that actually back to Danish and see what that looks like. Yeah, what I had to sort of query him about this time was this notion of third-party validation of carbon neutrality, because that is a bit, particularly in my area. I work at Otago Polytechnic. We've got multiple outlets. We've got multiple commercial kitchens. What I'd really like to do is actually see that us make that shift towards being carbon neutral, and I want to know, how do you measure that? So, you know, I had to ask him, how is your business certified as being carbon neutral?
I had an engineering company called Covi making the full calculation in 2013. That cost me in a Danish kroner, a little bit more than 100,000. So is that like 13,000 euros or something like that? But in 19, we were 99.91% CO2 neutral on scope 1 and 2. And the only reason we are not 100% is still because it still costs a little bit of CO2 to get windmill power into my factory. There's a little bit of loss in some kind of way. So that is why I'm missing the 0.9.
That must be
a little bit, but it's okay. Yeah.
Yes.
And that's also because I have my whole heating system, the way I'm running with on pellets, which we are producing ourselves, right? So,
yes.
So that's why we are. When you're looking into scope 3, then you're looking into on the fields and everything. And my big problem is actually that when I look at a simple thing like diesel, how much diesel is used on an organic field compared to a conventional? There's much more CO2 used on an organic field compared to a conventional field. So it's actually because they're running or going over the same field more times. Mechanical rinsing the for weed and stuff like that. So, and the output of the field is maybe 5 tons per acre on the conventional, and the organic is between 2.5 and 3.5. So that also needs to be taken into consideration on how many liter diesel per acre is used. So it's actually a pretty interesting discussion. Yeah. But people that are focusing on organic still believe that organic is better. If you're focusing on CO2, the conventional is better, right? If I should be going through scope 3 then and get the best result out of that, then I should skip all organic and only focus on conventional. And it's actually a quite fun discussion to have with people, because all people believe that organic is always better. And it is better in a lot of ways, right? It's good for nature. But if you're talking CO2, then it's not such a good story. But when you get tractors that are running on electricity and it's all CO2 neutral electricity, then that story changes, right? So
I don't think many people would argue with the notion of putting the best food in your body. But two things. One, it seems like an awful lot of work for a producer that's selling at the farmer's market to do to get certified. And two, even knowing that, we don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, like, I read this fantastic quote. I think it's P.G. O'Rourke, but don't hold that against me, which is like, everyone wants to save the earth and no one wants to help mum do the dishes. And I think what I take from that is that often it's actually in the small, it's in the small incremental stuff rather than the large bombastics. And for the farmer that's down at the farmer's market, more often than not, they're actually doing this. They're carbon neutral. They're close to the consumer. Their production methods, just by virtue of trying to cut costs, actually have like a serious reduction in carbon associated with them. And I think probably one of the things as a community that we could possibly do is start acknowledging that on a way. I would love to see that in a way that isn't wrapped around the notion of compliance, but is rather as a reinforcement of the positives which our food producers are doing.
But it goes very fast. And luckily, my production is actually quite simple. It's not very simple, but everything's run on electricity. And I don't have any kind of steam generators, or I don't need like 1500 degrees of doing something where you would normally use oil or natural gas, where electricity still have that issue of not reaching the levels you would need. I don't have that in my production. So in that kind of way, it's pretty easy, I would say. Yeah. I think the main issue is people have no clue what they're talking about, right? Because they don't know how complex it is, actually, what the life of the farmer is, how the market is changing stuff. At the moment, we see a huge decrease in organic sales in general in Denmark. I think we were at 15% of all groceries was organic. And I think this year we had 12%, simply because people want to save money. So suddenly, organic is not so important, right? Then they go to the conventional. So it is difficult. I know. And why wouldn't you put the best food in your body, right? That I don't understand. Maybe I'm also, because I'm producing food, so I'm spending more money on food, definitely. I'm buying more local also.
He's buying more local, are we?
I'd like to say yes. But
go on then.
I'll say yes. Yeah, we're all under pressure, financial. Everyone's in the same boat about this. We all desperately want to buy more local food. We all desperately want to be part of that more community-based food resilience supply chain. We very much want to be part of that. However, we have a lot of fiscal headwinds currently at the moment which are preventing a lot of that. It's very difficult for farmers to get to that tipping point where it's viable to make money out of supplying food. It's hard work. There's no way around that. I guess in a lot of ways, in what he was talking about there is all these sort of additional things that he does as being part of the community, as being carbon neutral, as being part of a wider network of change is what motivates him outside of the financial. And I think for a lot of food producers, you know, there is a lot of that to it. A lot of the farmers that we deal with, particularly who are in the same sort of position as him, look, the thing that motivates them is the fact that they are part of change, that they are part of positive. The orchard that we're dealing with from Ettrick Valley at the moment, he exports his fruit all the way around the world. And the question that was posed was, how can my fruit be part of the betterment or well-being of people? That's his motivation. And it's, you know, if you look at it that way, it's a pretty honourable thing. I don't think anyone in Apple computers thinks that way when they're making cell phones, is how is this going to contribute to my well-being? So, yeah, it's a tricky one. So, I mean, that kind of transitioned into future, you know, what is the future products look like for him? What are the future projects look like that he's working on at the moment?
It's pretty exciting. I think the most exciting stuff we're working with at the moment is like when we press rapeseed, one third becomes oil, two third is press cake, and that press cake goes into cattle feed mainly. And I'm now in three projects at the moment to get that press cake for human consumption, because you have around 32% protein in it. It's even higher than like chicken meat is like 28%. Yeah. So that is going to be my next big thing. It's the biggest protein, plant-based protein source we have in Europe. Depends on which project. So I'm just the guy delivering the rapeseed to them.
Right.
And they like my rapeseed because I don't have any shell in it, right? So they don't need to take that away first. So some of them are just looking into mechanically type of rinse it. The other one is more looking into kind of fermentation process. And the third one is looking into a specific type of enzymes they are working with at the moment. And because you have like stuff like mycotoxins in it that they want to take out. There are some interesting results actually, both on the enzyme and also on the fermentation. The mechanical, I don't really believe in it, but it's the cheapest way.
Using press cake for human consumption.
Yes.
Given that all the goodness is describing in it, it sounds like a no-brainer. Why are we not doing that already?
Why are we not doing that already? And that's a superb question. We have. I'll give you some statistics, Sam. This is good fun when I start playing this game. So during the cherry harvest in central Otago, one packing shed will throw away 2 tons of perfectly edible cherries a day. One packing shed. So you do the scales on that and you multiply that out. We do projects using the press cake that's left over from hazelnuts. Once again, it's high protein, high fiber, low fat material. It's very unscientifically turned into bacon by being fed to pigs, basically. One of the things that we have in New Zealand in particular is we have so much food. We have access to so much food is that we don't need to push ourselves. We don't need to, we consider eating insects as a form of protein to be a novelty. We have people that are extracting protein from wool over at Otago Uni. We have people extracting protein from grass up in Canterbury. Refeeding the grass back to the animals and reducing the methane outputs from that and increasing the protein content. We look at that as a novelty as a New Zealand consumer. We don't view it as being part of a global issue. And so I think when you hear someone like him talking about using the press cake, the way he's viewing it is not as a novelty. It's as a way to solve another problem. So for New Zealand, and because we're so fortunate in the country that we live in, maybe, and I'm just guessing here, maybe it is that we don't view it as the necessity that it should be.
Maybe you could get your students to work out how to catch and cook that fly that's been pestering us.
I can do something with it, because I'm too old and slow to catch it, so I'll have more luck at killing it.
Is it something that your students are keen on, this... not reuse, but this finding alternatives to the lowest outcome for what might have been considered food waste?
I'll have to be careful on this one, because I'm immediately going to say yes, they're immensely enthusiastic about it, but I'm not sure if it's them or if it's me. I know a lot of their projects revolve around using, quote-unquote waste stream products, but if you're in the middle of a ghetto in India, there is no waste stream product. So it's only waste stream product through a very sort of Western New Zealand lens, without getting too philosophical about it. But I always sort of maintain, particularly as a chef, as a student, cooking a steak is easy. That's not... anyone can do it. I can... give me 30 seconds, Sam, I'll teach you how to make the best steak in the world. It's not a particularly difficult thing to do. What's difficult is to get something which most people consider to be underutilized, unused, and turn it into something magnificent. That's the skill of being a chef. And I think that's where I hope, a lot of our students that come out of here start viewing things. Like, yes, there's a fiscal component to it, and yes, there's an ecological component to it, and yes, you could also argue that there's almost an environmental component to it. But there's also this other part, which is based around the skill and using imagination to change things.
That sounds like a great skill for them to have.
I hope so.
Where are we going next week?
Right, so I think we'll talk to the Green Solutions Hotel, and they have some really fascinating ways, and this is sort of getting back to my sort of area expertise, I would say, particularly in hospitality, the way hotels work, the role that hospitality has to play within the wider community, and how that community is interlinked. And as we've seen from all of these conversations, this community is very much interlinked.
And who are we going out to today?
So I thought we'd sort of carry on with the New Zealand art rock noise theme that we started off with HGU. This particular band has been the best band I've ever seen in the world and the worst band that I've ever seen in the world. When they were at their best, was in Auckland, and they were playing in a stadium, and the skies opened up and it poured with rain, and then the clouds went away and the sun came out and there was steam billowing up, and people had pulled up the boards that they were dancing on top of the grass, and there were people standing on top of it, and it was getting passed around, and it was quite a magical sight. And I remember thinking, gosh, is it just me that's saying, looking at this going, what an incredible concert this is. Several years later, I heard John Tugard from She Heart, when he was asked the best gig he'd ever been to, he was standing right beside the band as Owen played, and he quoted it as being the best gig he'd ever been to. And I thought, no, it wasn't. It wasn't just me. When I last saw them in Dunedin, however, it was disastrous. It was just disastrous. But we all had bad days at the office, so I won't go too far into that. So this is Belt Space and Deep Thing.
Their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. Welcome back, Tahu. I've been joined by Tim Lynch, who has brought us his conversation with Hemlik Henson of Lemsgaard on Bornholm. I'm Sam Lemay. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Ma te wa.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.